Well, this past spring, The Nation put out a poll suggesting that a majority of voters who voted for Donald Trump voted because of a fear of diversity. The findings say a majority of the Republicans that were polled said increased diversity was a negative. Now, when we say diversity, that usually falls along the lines of race. But more and more, that fear of diversity rears its head when it comes to issues of the LGBT communities. But a new book out on Oxford Press wonders why issues in the gay community, like marriage equality, have gone from nil in the public opinion to routinely accepted, especially in this age when we are so divided. How did attitudes change over decades and buck the trend of stable public opinion? For instance, legal abortions, the death penalty, those acceptance numbers have stayed the same over decades. But gay marriage, it went from 11% in 1988 to 60% acceptance in less than 20 years. The book is called Listen, We Need to Talk, How to Change Attitudes About LGBT Rights. Tonight, we talk about how to shift public opinion with the authors, Brian Harrison, who's a lecturer in political science at Northwestern University. Brian, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining me on the line is Melissa Michelson. She's a professor of political science at Menlo College. Melissa, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Justin.
All right. So let's. Where does this idea come from? I mean, is it essentially the idea that it's when you talk about a public poll and the idea of polling, we always see this public. It's just how we're asking the question, what the question's being asked of the people who are being polled?
Well, there's a little bit of that. I think you need to look at question wording. Depending on what you want the answer to be, you can ask the question that you will get that will get the desired answer. But really, the drivers of our work it's twofold. One was we looked at public opinion change, and it was odd. It's not what we would expect. If you look at other issues, like you mentioned, they're generally stable over time. They don't change quickly in the aggregate. But this issue changed, you know, dramatically overnight. So on one hand, we wanted to know why. And on the other hand, so that was sort of our academic reason. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, as human beings who want to see expanded rights for LGBT people, we wanted to look for ways that can actually increase support for those who identify as LGBT. So mm-hmm. the genesis of the project was sort of academic, and it was just practical. We want to see, you know, how do we help make the world a better place?
Right. Melissa, I mean, obviously throughout the book you talk about the reasons why, but I mean, there's a lot that goes in this, but at the same time, it is as simple as some of the leaders of social groups stepping forward and taking a stand, a pastor or a political leader. We saw with President Obama on gay marriage. But that seems to be a big part of changing the attitudes or the acceptance of a majority.
Exactly. So we're not manipulating public opinion by changing how we're asking it. It's more about who's talking about it and who's for it. And so if someone you look up to, someone you identify with, like your pastor or your president or a sports hero that you really admire, and they have a certain opinion, it makes you feel closer to them to share that opinion. And so you are more likely to change your mind and to be open to changing your mind if it's somebody you want to feel closer to.
You know, I think about that, and I think about politics, and a lot of times you'll have people make definitive statements. We see this with President Trump. We were kind of talking about it, Brian, just in the break about fake news. I mean, that's something that we're seeing play out even today. Or you see this idea of even, as I mentioned, President Obama talking about gay marriage. I mean, these are presidents. These are at the top. I mean, this is pretty obvious. But when you talk about leaders of social groups, and that's really what we're talking about here, who could they be? I mean, it's beyond presidents, political figures, pastors, et cetera.
So, well, my favorite experiment from the book uses Green Bay Packers Hall of Famer Leroy Butler to reach out to Packers fans.
Yeah, explain that.
Well, we did the experiment in Wisconsin, and of course there's quite a few people in Wisconsin who are fans of the Packers. And in one group of people, we told them that, and this is true, that Green Bay Packers Hall of Famer Leroy Butler supports same-sex marriage. And for the control group, we told them that Jay-Z does, and that is also true. And so, you know, they're both pretty famous black men, but only one of them is going to cue that shared identity, of being a Packers fan, of being a Packers hero that these Packers fans would look up to. And so if a Packers fan was exposed to the statement from Leroy Butler, they were much more likely to say they support same-sex marriage. About 15 percentage points more likely
wow.
than if they heard the statement from Jay-Z.
Well, I mean,
a huge effect. And, you know, pretty simple manipulation, just some local college students on the street handing out paper surveys.
Yeah, and if you think about it, I mean, that is a tactic that is used by commercials and products. I mean, the idea of a celebrity endorsement. I mean, is it that simple? The idea that people look up to sports figures, celebrities, and others, and if they have an opinion, they share that opinion?
We know from
it's not just celebrity, because then it would have worked for Jay-Z.
Right. Right.
It's something beyond that. It's that shared, strong identity of being a Packers fan. Just being a celebrity, just being famous, you know, then it wouldn't have worked.
Right.
Then it would have been the same.
So but it goes further than that.
It's that identity as a Packers fan.
Right.
And we know from social psychology that we sort of make sense of the social world by creating categories, and we're either in some and not in others. We like groups that we are in, and we tend to privilege those groups, and we tend to, if not openly dislike, at least not privilege groups that we're not in. So if you can appeal to what we have in common, and we can say, look at this thing, look at this identity that we both have, like Melissa mentioned, people want to feel close to in-group members, and you can use that closeness to try to nudge them on other issues. It doesn't always work. It might work for brand awareness, for example, because people don't have strong opinions about brands. It may not work for some social and political issues because people have too strong of opinions about them. But as the book shows, it can work on occasion. And not every study in the book actually worked as we had thought.
Well, there was one that was interesting here in Illinois, Equality Illinois, the idea of sending out calls to try and get people interested, mostly in the black population, by mentioning Coretta Scott King. This is really interesting. Explain what you tried to do here.
So here in Chicago, we were lucky to work with Equality Illinois, which was graciously, you know, opening their headquarters to us for a couple days. And what we did is we went to them and we said, you know, who do you want to persuade? What minds do you want to change? And they said, we don't really know how to speak to the black community in Cook County in 2010. And we came up with a design to say, okay, let's try a couple things and see what might make an impact. And one of the things we tried was using black callers. So we know from existing work in academia,
the actual people calling,
if they're of the same race as the recipients of the call, they're going to be more likely to be supportive of whatever it is that they're asking on the phone. And that held true here in Chicago. We also additionally tried a quotation from Coretta Scott King, sort of making an appeal to her husband, saying, you know, if he were alive today, he would be supportive. And so we should be supportive as well. It actually didn't work as well as we had thought. It worked somewhat, but not as well as we had thought. So we replicated that same study in Georgia. And we sort of did the same thing, except at that point, we had the president of the United States we could use his quotation. We used his quotation. In that instance, the quotation worked very, very well. But the in-group prime of the shared race really didn't work. So it's a matter of sort of finding the right formula for a social group.
I mean, a lot of this, Melissa, has to, I mean, again, we find ourselves in tribes and we find ourselves being political, dividing ourselves along political lines, Republican, Democrat. When you use President Obama or President Trump on the other side, automatically it seems to be goes back to that idea of this sort of shared, group social leader, you know, social group leader, who people will fall in line because they identify as Democrat or identify as Republican.
Absolutely. Partisanship is a powerful drug, and people are more likely to change their opinions than to change their partisanship.
Right.
And we see that over and over again, and we're, you know, seeing it today. So, yeah. So using political leaders, actually, the partisanship experiments we did were kind of the weakest ones because it was really hard to get people to kind of go against their party.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're talking about other identity groups, then it's not quite as strong of a drug as partisanship is.
Well, it's obvious that it goes over partisan lines when you talk about an issue like gay marriage, because that's normally going to be one that if you call a select group of liberals or Democrats, they're going to say you're going to find a higher majority in that group. But this, I mean, to watch something that went from 10% or 11% to 60% acceptance over time, that is bipartisan. That has more to do with the fact that people are coming around on an issue than who they vote for.
And we see
that's true, but we still have pretty high levels of disapproval among conservative Republicans and older Republicans. Mm-hmm. So if you're looking for the holdouts on this issue, it does tend to be Republicans.
Brian, do you see, are there issues that are similar?
I just wanted to add one thing. Every social group, that every identifiable group is moving to be more supportive of marriage equality. It's just the rate at which they're changing. There's a poll that came out today that showed that 74% of Democrats and 71% of independents supported marriage equality. Only 47% of Republicans did. So I think, just to speak to our work, if there was a prominent Republican that came out in favor of marriage equality, it maybe in the way that President Obama did, that might make a difference. It probably wouldn't, you know, jump to 74, but it certainly would make a difference. There really is no high-profile Republican, other than maybe Dick Cheney, who is maybe a murky Q in the Republican Party, but there aren't prominent Republicans who are supportive. But in terms of issues that are similar, I think the one that comes to mind is marijuana. Like, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, social and political issues generally are stable over time. People think what they think, and they like to be consistent. But marijuana use, both recreationally and medicinally, has changed remarkably quickly. And I think that's an issue where our theory of dissonant identity priming might apply really well. And I think there are others, but that's the first one that comes to mind.
Brian Harrison is in studio with me tonight. Melissa Michelson is on the line. We're talking about the book, Listen, We Need to Talk, How to Change Attitudes About LGBT Rights. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll continue our conversation here on The Download. Stay with us. In studio with me tonight on The Download, the authors of Listen, We Need to Talk, How to Change Attitudes About LGBT Rights. Joining me in studio, Brian Harrison, a lecturer in political science at Northwestern University. Also on the phone, Melissa Michelson. She's a professor of political science at Menlo College. You know, this is a book that is not just about, as you mentioned at the top, LGBT rights. That's part of what you're talking about. But this is really pointing to one issue in our society that has shown a pattern of improvement when it comes to attitude. It's changed. I mean, this is, you poll in 1988 is different than 2016. And that's a very small amount of time. We're talking about 15, 20 years where you've seen a remarkable change in the attitudes of Americans. But this issue, Brian, and I have to ask, I mean, this is an issue that's as long as time, so this idea of accepting LGBT rights. So what do you look at to be the change? What changed in the last 15 years that wasn't available 100 years ago?
Sure. We don't want to give the impression that LGBT rights started in 1996 when the question about marriage equality started being asked routinely. Obviously, throughout the 20th century, LGBT rights have been a prominent American struggle. And so we can look back to the 1950s when we had the Lavender Scare and the president issued an executive order to purge the government of all homosexuals because they were a safety risk. We can look to a documentary in 1967 on CBS News that Mike Wallace did that was called The Homosexual, that talked about how the average gay man was, you know, lecherous and a danger to society. So there were decades and decades of struggle and fight and disease and some very dark times for the LGBT community. So I don't want to give the impression that, you know, magically, oh, look, everything is rosy. We don't ignore history. We don't want to ignore the last 80 years.
But why? I mean, yeah, there has been forces against change, you know, through you just mentioned two. I mean, huge, an executive order or a documentary that's seen on CBS. Those are huge deals. What was the change? What, in your estimation, when you look at this, what was it about this issue, marriage equality, gay marriage, that had such an explosion in 15 years' time?
I don't think there's one single thing. I think there's a variety of things. And one of them is LGBT people started coming out. And people realized, oh, my neighbor, my dentist, my kid's teacher, people in my world.
My family members
absolutely are LGBT. And that obviously changed minds. It's something that becomes more salient, more close to you. And so that's obviously one big thing. The second thing is non-LGBT people started speaking out in support too. And I really think that's when the tide changed. And that's really what the book is about, how social group leaders and social group members of groups other than LGBT coming out in support really changes the minds of that social group. We can also point to media portrayals, and there are more and more LGBT people in the media and more positively portrayed in the media. Mm-hmm. There's a whole bunch of things.
Right.
And this book really focuses on the social group aspect.
All right, Melissa, I got a question about, I mean, this is what you guys are doing with the book, which is tremendous. The idea of looking at some of the social issues of our time and trying to sort of piece together a case study for why we've seen drastic change. I mean, in the book, you label it, it's extreme political science or experimental political science, right? Talk about this concept, the idea of creating a new type of political science that will help understand how we change social issues in the future?
Well, experiments have kind of been at the forefront of political science research since 2000. It's a growing subfield where instead of just observing, we're kind of moving into the realm of quote-unquote real science or medical science, like how they do drug trials or they expose people to different messages. So it's, you know, it's not really that new because I guess now it's 2017, so it's been around for a decade and a half. But it's definitely kind of the trendy kind of political science to do experiments. It's also pretty new to do things that are involving the real world that are, you know, working in cooperation with advocacy organizations, doing things that are going to maybe affect the real world rather than just observe it. That's actually pretty controversial for some political scientists. They disapprove of work that is involved in the real world. And Brian and I, of course, are fans of that sort of thing. We're doing our work to change the world, not to just watch it. So it is a little bit different, but I don't want to overstate that because we are definitely following in the footsteps of some other folks that have been doing this sort of thing for the last decade and a half.
Both of you in this book, I mean, to take on the idea of social groups or identity theory and to really sort of put names to some of the things of why, as human beings, we group up and decide what we like and what we don't like. I mean, that's really what it is. I mean, but a lot of this book, Brian, and this is the fun part about it is really starting to break down, you know, everything for, I mean, what it takes to change attitudes, one of which is persuasion. You know, we talked about this idea of social group leaders and persuasion plays a big part. But at the end of the day, when you're just talking about the practical uses, I mean, it's simple sort of kindergarten type stuff where you're like, you know, one of one of the staples in the book, if you want to begin this process of changing attitudes, there needs to be a willingness to listen.
Absolutely. And that is an academic construct and it's a practical one, right? If you're trying to persuade someone of something, if you're saying something to them in order to change their mind, if they don't listen to you, if they don't think what you're saying is important to them or relevant to them, if they don't believe what you're saying, obviously what you're saying is going to have no effect.
Right.
So the book really looks at the ways that we can make information relevant to people in ways that it may not otherwise be. By simply saying, you know, listen, we need to talk about the things we have in common rather than the things that we have in difference. So, you know, you're sitting at the Thanksgiving table and, you know, your drunk Uncle Larry says something crazy. You can say to your family, no, you know, people like us shouldn't tolerate that kind of homophobia, or people like us don't believe those
right.
kinds of things.
And Melissa, I'll give you the last word on this, but I mean, it is interesting because this really does have to do, I mean, it's political science, but it's also human science in the way that we do group up. I mean, there's this us versus theirs. There's, you know, you mentioned it at one point just about the idea of this is identity theory. You're either with a group or you're against a group. How do you change attitudes when you're really going against what we know to be human nature?
Well, you got to use human nature, not go against human nature. And so it's all about finding that link with people so that they don't dismiss what you have to say and so that they do listen to you. And, you know, that's not always obvious. You might not necessarily know whether the best way to reach out to somebody is through their religious identity or their sports fan identity or, you know, some other identity that they hold very strongly. But if you can find that connection, you know, maybe you both really like opera. Maybe you both have the same favorite TV show. You find a way to connect with someone, you make that human connection, and then once they're listening to you, then you can start having a persuasive conversation.
Melissa Michelson is a professor of political science at Menlo College. Brian Harrison, a lecturer in political science at Northwestern University. Their book is called Listen, We Need to Talk, How to Change Attitudes About LGBT Rights. I want LGBT rights, excuse me. Brian, Melissa, thanks so much for taking some time out. We appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thanks, Justin.